takes care of that. So before we get started, we're gonna take a break. Anybody need to take a break or anything? If not, there you go. Okay. Well, I have an old business in now.
The old business is case number 11296, application of AT&T. Site is located east of Route 1 Coastal Highway, 100 feet north of Jefferson Bridge Road, also known as Route 361A, and being identified on the tax map ID as 134, map 17.07, parcel 191. Requesting a special use exception for a telecommunication tower. And this application of old business was continued from the November 18, 2013 public hearing for rebuttal purposes only.
Mr. Chairman, before we get started, are we going to have any rules or time limitations or anything this evening? Because personally, I don't feel like being here until 1 o'clock this morning or tomorrow morning.
Has there been any established?
Not that I'm aware of, Mr. Chairman. I did want to make a statement on the record, which may alleviate some of your concerns, Mr. Mills. The Planning and Zoning Office received a letter and I believe a CD from some opposition last week. I have reviewed the contents of that. Because the record, and this is a little unique, normally we try to get them all in one hearing, but this one had some unique circumstances, and because we are going into a second meeting, that this was held open for rebuttal purposes only. So the applicant has, my understanding, will have the floor tonight. Because of that, that letter and CD were not admitted as part of the public record. But the board has in the past allowed for server rebuttal, which is very limited in scope, just as the rebuttal is limited in scope, the rebuttal being limited to comments made by the opposition at the hearing last time, and then the server rebuttal will be even further limited to the comments made in the rebuttal. So for that purpose, the applicant will have the floor this evening, and I presume we would go from there. And because of that limited nature of the reason you left it open, I think that all comments tonight should also be very limited in nature, and so that they're not repetitive of what we've heard before.
Right. They'll be just limited to the oppositions.
Correct.
Right. And then if there was... that we've heard before won't be repeated then.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Is it correct to say that any rebuttal in opposition could only be in rebuttal to the comments made by the applicant?
Correct. Well, and there was a brief bit of rebuttal at the end of the last hearing, but it was very brief. I believe there was a witness who was I think it was Mr. Foster. So, but yeah, it's limited to responses to that.
And I would also advise the board that staff did receive three or four letters with copies available with the CD for members of the board, and those were not distributed. Those letters have been stamped and received after the public hearing, for the record.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good evening, members of the board. My name is Richard Forston, here on behalf of AT&T, and this is the time that has been set aside for AT&T's response to the objections raised by opponents at the Monday, November 19th hearing. On behalf of AT&T, I'd like to thank you for not having us go till who knows how long we could have gone that night. There was a lot presented by opponents. I think they went for a lot longer than we did. And so we've got some stuff to respond to, but we've worked very hard to keep it as brief as possible and as efficient as possible in our presentation, because I don't want to be here until the wee hours either. I want to start with the observation that I made when we started back on Monday, November 9th, and that's simply this. We recognize the right of the surrounding property owners to come out and appear at the public hearing. They were passionate about their property, and people don't like things in their backyard, and we get that. And people should be passionate about their properties. It's one of their most important investments. And incidentally, I sit on a school board, and if there's one thing folks are more passionate about than their property, it's their kids. So I know what it's like to have people come and speak passionately in front of you. But at the same time, there are standards that apply, standards that Sussex County Council has put in place, and we are governed by the rule of law, not the rule of men. And so while AT&T appreciates what the immediate neighbors came out and said, at the same time, some of what they said and some of what their experts said just wasn't true, it wasn't accurate. And that's not necessarily their fault. I don't think it was necessarily done intentionally. You know, in these sorts of situations, these public hearings where people just come to a microphone and speak, it's not, I'm used to being in court where, you know, the lawyers trade information back and forth. You don't do that in these sorts of settings. And so sometimes there are misstatements made. And so our job tonight is to correct those misstatements. Before I call our witnesses, I just want to outline what they're going to be saying. There were issues about construction and public safety. There were things said about the proposed tower that just aren't true. And I think some of the board members actually picked up on that. Or there were claims that there was flooding in the area or excessive water in the area, and somehow the temporary tower that's there was causing this problem. Well, the answer is no. The temporary tower hasn't done anything to the stormwater pond that's there, and I believe at least one or two of the members of the board picked up on the fact that there's just been a lot of rain the last couple years, and that it's nothing about the tower that's been causing that flooding. Incidentally, if we are permitted to go forward, one of the things that AT&T is going to investigate with the property owner is actually increasing the capacity of the stormwater pond. So not only will drainage not be impacted by the new structure if you all grant approval, we may be able to actually make the situation better than it is. There was also testimony about a small antenna on top of an electric transmission line about 0.6 miles or so down the road from this site, and you were told that this was an AT&T tower, and in fact, some people said AT&T was lying to you, was misleading. They said worse things than that. It's not an AT&T facility. It is a T-Mobile facility. Now, at one point, there was actually a sticker on that facility that said it was AT&T. So I have no doubt that that was probably part of the confusion. But as Brock Briffle will testify in a few minutes, it's a T-Mobile facility. AT&T doesn't have that kind of equipment or technology. And so that's a solution that doesn't work for AT&T. Finally, there was a lot of testimony about value. And as I said at the outset, this is a really unique situation that's been presented with this application because we've had a temporary tower up for 3 years. And so we're in a position to look at the market before the tower went up, and we're in a position to look at the market after the tower went up. And as you'll recall, and it was in the notebooks that we gave to you, and we have a chart, the market went up, it went down, it started to go up, it's gone down again, and that's exactly the experience of Sea Pines. It's followed the market almost perfectly. And so while normally people might speculate, oh, this tower is going to cause all sorts of bad things, it's going to cause our property values to fall substantially, we have the data, and the data disproves that. So, and we also incidentally had the chart of sales of two-bedroom condominium units that don't have a view of the water going back the last 2 years. And of the top 10 sales, including the top two, six were in the Sea Pines community. So, again, I don't think it's fair to say that there has been any sort of effect on value, let alone a substantial effect on value, when you look at the actual data. You see what the professional literature, which has been cited in the appraisals from our experts, predicts and says, and that is that just like utility poles, just like utility lines, just like the general urban landscape, these things fade into the background and you don't even notice them. I mean, and as the pictures in what we showed you indicated, there are 60-foot utility poles that run along the front of the Sea Pines community. You have to drive under them to get into the Sea Pines community. There's a Holiday Inn Express across the street. There's a restaurant across the street that serves crabs. There's a combination gas station and Arby's that these things back up to. And, of course, there's Route 1 itself. Mr. McCain, one of our appraisers, is going to testify about his review of the rentals. And one of the things he's going to discuss, because the opposition said, oh, people see the tower and they don't want to rent here anymore. Well, Mr. McCain reviewed online comments. You know, people, when they rent, can leave comments online. And it's interesting. People complained about the smell of the crabs from the restaurant across the street. People complained about the view of the gas station. They never complained about the cell tower. And again, we're just looking at what's online, so all I can offer you is the actual data. And one of the residents, I think, actually helped AT&T in our case. You'll remember one of the residents, he's got one of the units that actually backs up to the Arby's. His deck overlooks the Arby's parking lot where the drive-thru is and the gas pumps are. And you'll recall that he testified that for the last three summers, he's been able to fully rent his unit. Pretty good. He said, though, that he didn't have any repeat renters, which he thought was a problem. And the only thing he could think of as to why he didn't have repeat renters was the temporary cell tower. Now, with respect, it might be the view of the gas station, which people have complained about. It might be the smell of the crabs from the restaurant, which people have complained about online. That Arby's parking lot's got is lit. There's a drive-through. It could be any of those factors. But guess what? His unit's fully rented. So if his unit's fully rented, and he's the only person who testified about actual rental experience, there's no evidence from opponents that this has had any sort of effect on rentals. People speculate, but when you actually look at the data, it's not there. So I could go on, but I don't want to take up your time. I'd like to just call our witnesses, and as I say, I think I can be quite efficient and brief. I only have a few questions for each of them to, again, rebut some of the testimony. They've all been previously sworn, and I believe then that that would continue.
Yeah, we might as well just redo it tonight, so we've got another evening and continue. So,
okay, well, I'd like to start with Mr. Mario Calabretta.
Good evening. Can you state your name and address for the record?
Mario Calabretta, M-A-R-I-O, Calabretta, C-A-L-A-B-R-E-T-T-A, 900 South Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, Lewis Road, Royersford, R-O-Y-E-R-S-F-O-R-D, Pennsylvania, 19468.
And do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give us the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Calabretta, could you just briefly remind the board members of your profession, your qualifications, and the role that you're playing here tonight on behalf of AT&T?
Sure. I am a civil engineer. I've been working in the telecommunications industry for the last 14 years, working on new site builds like this particular site, as well as existing upgrade facilities or sites on buildings, water tanks, et cetera. I have a Master's of Science degree from the University of Maryland, and I've been working with AT&T for many, many years, but also every other telecommunications carrier in the business these days.
Thank you. We heard testimony a few weeks back that there's a flooding problem or a drainage problem in the area, and that somehow this temporary tower was causing that. Can those assertions be correct, and why or why not?
No. The water level primarily has to do, obviously, with the amount of rainfall in a given time period, as well as surface features, areas that channel or collect water. The only way that the flooding in a given area could get worse for a given instance would be to introduce some structure, some large body that would actually allow that water to rise. Very similar to simple examples when you get into a bathtub, for example. Your body sinks into the tub and the water level rises. That kind of physical change would require a significant intrusion into the actual volume of water that's being dealt with, particularly at the retention basin. It's just not possible for the area, or the volume, I should say, of the equipment that's in that site to have any effect on the water level within that drainage basin itself. It's just not mathematically possible.
And moving forward, when the permanent tower, assuming that it's approved, is installed, would that permanent tower have any adverse impact on drainage?
No, it wouldn't, and precisely for the same reason. I ran some quick numbers. There's almost 10,000 square feet of area in that retention basin. To increase that area to increase the elevation of that capacity of that water structure 1 inch, you'd have to introduce 800 cubic feet, over 800 cubic feet of volume, whether it be at the base of the tower or the foundation of the actual shelter itself. I did some quick numbers, and we're increasing about 100 cubic feet, 1/8 of the amount of area that it would, or volume it would take to raise that volume by 1 inch, which essentially translates to about a 1/8 inch increase in water level. So again, we're suggesting that if we were to do anything at all, and that's making no changes whatsoever, if we were to proceed with the facility, we would make sure that that net increase would actually be zero. It wouldn't even be 1/8, and that would involve perhaps reworking some of the area directly in front of the tower itself, or whatever it would take, frankly, to make sure that we have no impact. But at the very worst, it's negligible.
And I just want to be clear on that point. My understanding, and indeed I think there's a letter from Sussex Conservation, states that when we put the permanent tower in, we have to make sure that the stormwater pond has, at a minimum, the same capacity. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. I just have two final quick questions. One of the exhibits was submitted by opponents, Exhibit 2, purported to show a view of the tower from and the Arby's parking lot from Sea Pines. I'll say both before the tower went up and then after the tower after the permanent tower is constructed, and it showed a bunch of arrays at the top of the tower. How accurate is Exhibit 2, the post photo?
Looking at the photos, I noticed two things. One, in the pre-photo, I don't see the existing pole that's there. We're approximately in the same location, not very far off. That would have been a good indicator of how much taller our structure will be. The existing pole is approximately 80 feet tall. We're going to a structure that's 100 feet tall, so essentially increasing that height by 25%. It would have been helpful to see that pole in this picture. I don't see it there for whatever reason. The after, though, I will say is a bit shocking. I prepare photo simulations for a living for my clients at times, and I've done photo simulations showing what a structure would look like before and after, and there are various means to do that. I cannot in any way think that this is an accurate representation of what a 100-foot monopole would look like in this particular area. The scale is wrong. It looks like to me that somebody took a picture of a pole and frankly stretched it. If I were looking at those antennas at this vantage point, I would assume those antennas are probably 8 to 10 feet tall, where our antennas are probably anywhere from 4 to 5 feet tall. So it seems to me that this is just I can't comment on the qualifications of the person who did it, but it doesn't seem to me like it represents in any way an actual or factual representation or an accurate representation of what a 100-foot structure would look like beyond the area in the background there.
And so just briefly to sum up, will the cell tower be constructed in accordance with all applicable construction and safety standards?
Yes, of necessity.
Thank you. I don't have any further questions unless any
members. Are there any questions from board members?
Yeah. Yeah, on the pond. The tower now is about, I looked at it, about, it's about, what, 10, 15 feet from it now, the pond, drain pond?
Yeah, the pond itself varies based on what kind of conditions there are. There's meant to be a permanent level of water in the pond at all times, and then there's some area or some volume that will fluctuate based on the condition. So it varies how far away it is. It's not permanent.
So where the tower's at now, you're going to be farther away from that drainage pond, right? As you said last meeting?
We're actually parallel to it. The pond itself runs parallel to the rear parking lot.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So we're not moving further into it to get it. We're moving the pole to get away from one of the property lines, but we're running essentially parallel to the parking lot in between sort of the alleyway between the parking lot and the actual drainage area. So we're not going further into or further away from the edge. We're kind of running alongside of it.
So you still be the same distance from that?
Very close, yeah, approximately.
Very close?
Yes.
And that's suitable for that? I mean, being that,
well,
it didn't look that far away from that pond to me.
Yeah, it's not, for me personally, from a technical perspective, the dirt or the substructure in any of that area is not the biggest concern, frankly, because what we'll do before this is constructed and before a permit is issued is do a geotechnical investigation, which involves bringing a boring rig out there that will actually bore 20, 30, 40, 80 feet, at whatever depth it needs to go before it finds soil that's suitable for this structure. So that foundation will be designed with this location in mind, designed specifically for it. So it's going to be, it may be a different kind of foundation that might be on a mountaintop or in a farm field in Pennsylvania, for example. It will be designed for this particular site.
Type of soil.
And basically, if it was oatmeal, we would design a foundation for it, frankly. We would do what we would have to from an engineering perspective to make sure that it can be built. So from a technical perspective, I look at this site and I think, no, there's no compelling issues here in terms of concerns, as opposed to, let's say, building one in the middle of a river, which, where I come from, near Brandywine, there's PICO transmission lines that run through the Brandywine River. So, again, from an engineering perspective, this is sort of a ho-hum project.
Okay, and one other question. Was that tower there when Sandy went through?
Yes.
Hurricane Sandy.
Hurricane
yes,
Sandy.
Yes, it was.
It was there.
It was constructed in June of 2010. So, and Sandy was last October, I believe. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Also, along with that, the monopole that is being applied for here. How would you compare from a civil engineering standpoint that structure compared to what's there now?
What we propose would be a permanent installation, and because of that, the foundation itself, again, would be specifically designed for a structure capable of handling what's being proposed. What's out there now is a utility pole. I believe it's just driven into the ground, very similar to a typical utility pole that would be holding power lines. What we're proposing would be significantly on a higher level, let's say, in terms of a scale of structure, because we would be putting in a foundation specifically designed for this, and frankly with something that would actually have the capacity for greater loading
bottom line, it would be much more substantial than what's there now.
Oh, yes. No. Okay. By magnitudes, frankly.
Thank you.
One other question. If this tower gets put up, say 5 or 6 years, you don't use it anymore. Did AT&T take that? Do they take that down? Who takes that? Who's responsible for that?
AT&T.
So I mean, if they don't use it, will they take the tower down?
Yes. There'd be no point in having it up because there's maintenance costs and everything else. But all the market studies tell you that it'll still be.
I mean, because it's on his land, though.
It's on the property owner's land. And AT&T pays a pursuant to the lease, pays a rental fee, mm-hmm. and then they don't want to pay. If you're not using it, you're not going to pay the fee. But in order not to pay the fee, you got to take it down.
Okay.
And besides that, I think the county has a rule in that if you abandon.
Sure. If you don't use it for a period of 6 months, you got to take it down under
take
the county
down.
Code anyway. But
I think Verizon does the same
cover.
Thing.
That would
right.
cover it once you abandon it for 6 months. So
yes.
That would be down there.
Okay. One more question. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. At this time, I would like to call Mr. Brock Riffle.
State your name and address for the record.
Brock Riffle, Phoenixville, PA. BROCKRIFFEL.
Do you swear or affirm your testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Riffle. Can you just briefly remind us of your profession, your qualifications, and your role here tonight on behalf of AT&T?
Sure. I have a Bachelor's of Science in Electrical Engineering from Drexel University, with a focus on telecommunication signals and systems. I have roughly 17 years experience designing radio frequency networks and communication facilities directly for the major wireless carriers in this area, Verizon Wireless, AT&T, and Clearwire. And for this application, I'm discussing AT&T's application before you.
And so during the presentation a few weeks back by the opponents, one of the gentlemen testified that he and his wife drove around the area a week or so before the hearing and couldn't find any gaps in coverage. I mean, does that surprise you, and why or why not?
No, it does not surprise me. As was spoken to earlier, there has been a temporary facility up since 2010. So obviously AT&T does have temporary coverage, reliable coverage in the area. So for anyone to go out and test since that temporary facility was up, they obviously would not see the gap in coverage that we're describing.
And along those lines, one of the residents introduced AT&T promotional maps, coverage maps for the area, that showed coverage is good in the Bethany Beach area. Is there any reason to doubt those advertisements?
No, and again, because there is a temporary facility there, and it is providing good coverage to the area. So, of course, AT&T, in their promotional material, is reflecting that.
Okay. Let's talk about Dr. Raines and his report and testimony. Previously, just to remind the members of the board, Dr. Raines had testified that there was going to be this sphere of radio waves and radiation. But Dr. Foster, you'll recall, during our brief rebuttal, this was the only thing he rebutted, pointed out that that's not going to be a sphere. It's going to just be a very thin pancake. So that was one mistake that was in Dr. Raines' testimony and report. But were there other misstatements and mistakes in Dr. Raines' testimony? And could you point them out to us or briefly review them for us?
Sure. There were. I guess my overwhelming concern with the report and testimony is the lack of data to actually back some of that up. Additionally, based on his CV as well as testimony, I'm not aware of Dr. Raines actually having any experience designing wireless networks or wireless communication facilities. He does speak to having extensive experience in designing antennas, designing signal boosters, tracking down interference. However, I did not see anywhere in his CV or his testimony that he has worked directly for any of the major wireless carriers designing networks. I think that's why maybe some of the data was somewhat inaccurate or maybe missing.
And so with that understanding that maybe cell network design isn't really his forte, can you give us some specific examples of mistakes that might have crept into his presentation?
Sure. In his summary sheet, the first point that he makes out, his statement is that AT&T does not have a gap in coverage, and that he bases that on one of his exhibits, I believe it was R2, where he makes a statement that the ideal range of a cell phone is 6 miles. He also then uses an arbitrary safety margin, as he calls it, to bring that down to a two-mile reliable distance. Number one, he doesn't have any equation or data to back that up. Additionally, there are far more factors that go into calculating the coverage distance of a cell phone, that being the frequency that's being transmitted, the height of the transmitting and receiving antennas, the underlying terrain as that signal travels through, as well as the type and gain of antennas. And lastly, and maybe most importantly, is the clutter that exists. He speaks to an ideal range. However, AT&T's customers and every customer in the wireless industry almost never is using their phone in an ideal environment. They're using them in their houses. They're using them in cars that are moving. They're using them in restaurants and businesses. All of these different clutter types, as well as some of the non-man-made stuff, such as the trees that we've discussed earlier, dramatically impact the distance that radio frequency signals travel. So it is far too simplistic to draw a circle on a map and state that there's a coverage range or an ideal coverage range of a cell phone of 6 or 2 miles for that matter.
And Dr. Raines also testified, or he just made the claim, that the software used by AT&T and others to identify gaps in coverage was just really, as far as I could tell, not worth the computer it's run on. What is your take, or what is your response to that idea that the software used by the cell phone companies isn't any good?
I would absolutely disagree. Again, he offered no data to support that statement. Secondly, AT&T throughout the entire country uses the same propagation software. Every single engineer, every single market across the whole entire country uses this tool, and they use it to base decisions that cost AT&T billions of dollars. The tool is very accurate. Additionally, every major wireless carrier in the country and the world uses similar software and have been doing so for the past 20 years to base all of these same decisions. In the Philadelphia market specifically, they hired a third party to basically take field data from AT&T's actual network and inject it back into the tool to calibrate it even further to make it even more accurate. So I would absolutely disagree with his statement that the industry standard software that was used is not accurate.
Dr. Raines testified in part that he thought the problem in the Bethany Beach area wasn't one of coverage. He said it was one of interference. Is that correct, and why or why not?
Again, I didn't see any data to support that statement, and AT&T does not have an interference problem in this area. And just to define that, interference from a radio frequency standpoint is where you have unwanted radio frequency that comes into your licensed frequency band or right next to it. It's similar, I guess the analogy might be, is if I'm speaking to you now and someone just came up and started talking loudly. So it would be much more difficult for me to communicate with all of you. AT&T does not have an interference problem in this area. And additionally, proposing a new facility would never be the proper solution to solving an interference issue. In fact, since the temporary site is there today working adequately, it would not be solving an interference problem if we had it, and we would still have to go out and fix that interference issue if there was one there. Sorry.
Okay. Dr. Raines also claimed that there were any number of structures in the area that would be, I think his words were, equally good to the proposed location. Is that correct?
That's not correct. There are no other available structures that would negate the need for the proposed facility that we're discussing.
Right, and just to, I mean, you heard actually the commissioner from Bethany Beach. I mean, if we could go on the Bethany Beach water tower, that would solve the problem. We wouldn't need this tower. Bethany Beach has said no. So there are other structures. We just can't use them. Somebody mentioned, and along those lines, somebody mentioned the 50-foot radio antenna at the Bethany Beach Fire Hall as a possibility. Would that work?
Number one, that is not available to us. We did investigate that facility. Secondly, it's 50 feet tall. So if we were allowed to house our antennas on that facility, AT&T would still have gaps to the north and to the south in the coverage gap that they currently have.
Okay. One of the things that someone mentioned, I think it was Dr. Raines, was that under federal regulations, 911 calls must be handled by other providers so that if the proposed tower were not in place, then the 911 calls that it handles, which is approximately two a day, could be handled by another carrier. Is that correct?
The rule does exist. However, in reality, that's not accurate. There's several components of that that he did not address or leave out. For instance, in order for a AT&T customer to make a 911 call on another network, that network would have to be of the same technology, and the phone would also have to be capable of transmitting in the frequency band that the other carrier had. Lastly, that other carrier would have to have reliable service in the area. For instance, in this market, an AT&T phone will not operate on Verizon Wireless's network. It will also not operate on Sprint's network. The last remaining major carrier would be T-Mobile. An AT&T phone would work on T-Mobile's network, but again, it would have to meet that criteria. It would have to be a newer phone that operated in T-Mobile's band and using the same technology. So we are very limited of where that would actually really work in practice.
And speaking of T-Mobile, since you brought it up, one of the things that Dr. Raines talked about, and others as well, was they pointed to the facility south about 0.6 miles, where there was an antenna at the top of, I think it's a 60-foot utility transmission line. And it was claimed that that was an AT&T antenna and that we were misleading the board and we were a bunch of liars and all that sort of stuff. But what can you tell us about that particular equipment and about the use of poles by AT&T more generally?
That facility is not an AT&T facility. In fact, to someone in the industry like myself, I can typically tell you exactly what carrier exists at a location based on the way their antennas look or their equipment below. Additionally, it's also industry practice to label the electric meters at each site. So when there's multiple carriers, everyone knows where each electric meter is housed. At that facility, if you go look on the electric meter, there's a placard and it says OMC. That stands for Omnipoint Communications, which is the old name for T-Mobile. So I'm absolutely sure that that is a T-Mobile location. The only AT&T facilities in the general area are the ones that I presented to the board on the exhibits. There are no other AT&T facilities in the area, including the one that was incorrectly identified by Dr. Raines.
And I believe that that equipment had at some time some sort of sticker on it that said it was AT&T. Can you tell us about that sticker?
That's correct. The sticker actually did have AT&T designated on it. However, the actual site number that was associated with that sticker belonged to the temporary facility. So somehow, some way, that sticker was put on a T-Mobile facility incorrectly. As soon as AT&T was made aware of that, they removed the sticker, and the sticker or placard was put on the temporary facility correctly, correctly identifying that, you know, the temporary facility is, in fact, AT&T's.
Now, more generally, okay, you've got T-Mobile, they've got an antenna, they've got something strapped to the pole, and so it does raise the logical question, well, how come AT&T can't do that? So how come AT&T can't do that?
AT&T doesn't have any equipment that can be configured in the way that T-Mobile did at that location. Additionally, AT&T has roughly 2.5 times the amount of customers that T-Mobile has, and they have roughly 2 times the spectrum, the radio frequency spectrum portfolio. That translates to them having a far greater equipment footprint that they need to have. Additionally, as was testified last week, they are also proposing to put a backup generator at the facility so that in times of power outages and emergencies, the network will still operate. In my 17 years, I've never seen an installation from the two largest carriers, that being Verizon and AT&T, where they were able to strap all of their equipment or their equipment shelter to the bottom of a pole like T-Mobile can. It's also important to note that also in Dr. Raines' report and testimony, he stated that there was a Verizon facility that did, in fact, have their equipment strapped to the pole at 5 points. He, again, was incorrect. That is a T-Mobile facility, and I was also at that facility as well.
Okay. One of the things you mentioned was generators, and obviously, can you tell us a little bit more? For example, I understand the FCC is now proposing or considering a rule that would require all facilities to have generators. Is that correct?
That's correct. They're investigating that right now. But in addition, AT&T has an internal mandate that they will be putting generators at every new facility that they construct. Additionally, they're going back to all of the existing facilities that do not have backup generators, and they're installing them there as well. And this was basically as a lesson that was learned off of Storm Sandy, where the wireless network was used dramatically for people to communicate. And if there's no power, there's no wireless network. So that's why they need the backup generator there to produce the needed power for all the equipment that they use.
Okay. One of the opponents had a picture from a project, I believe was in Palo Alto, California, that showed small antennas, or relatively small antennas, I suppose, on the top of regular utility poles. I understand that that technology, which is called DAS for Distributed Antenna System, really won't work in this area. Can you explain why that's the case?
Sure. It's really not the proper design, and it's also not realistic. In order for that to work, you would need many antenna locations. And based on my design experience in evaluating distributed antenna systems, I would estimate that you would need roughly 20 facilities interspersed throughout the Bethany Beach area. They would be very similar antennas that what we're discussing today, a four-foot panel or a cylindrical antenna. They'd be placed on top of the 20-foot utility poles, I guess you would call them, that are interspersed throughout Bethany Beach. And typically they are used for providing service to a very niche area, maybe a small stretch of roadway where there's nothing to impede the signal. So obviously the road's there, there's nothing on the road other than the vehicles. The signal can travel down those roadways relatively easily. Conversely, in this area, obviously, when you have houses that are just as tall as these antennas will be off the ground, and you have trees that are just as tall, if not taller, they dramatically reduce the distance that the signal will propagate. On average, you may be able to get the signal to propagate 500 to 1,000 feet. So as you can see, there would be a dramatic need for a lot of these facilities, and obviously you'd have similar opposition to just the one facility that we're proposing this evening.
I don't have any other further questions, so unless board members have questions.
No, I have a question. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can clear my mind on this. You said there's the opposition said there was no problem in receiving or transmitting right now. And you weren't surprised at that, right? Because you got a temporary tower up.
You're absolutely correct.
How high is the temporary tower?
I believe the antennas are right at 80 or 85 feet.
And you're asking for a 100-foot tower.
That's correct.
Why? Why do you need something higher?
Well,
I just want to know why, because you seem to give me the impression they're satisfied right now
with 85.
Yeah, I testified last time we were here that AT&T is still receiving complaints in the heart of Bethany Beach for poor service, unreliable service. Additionally, it's important to note that the network was not designed for 85 feet. That's just a constraint of a wood pole.
Your attorney said that there's no problem there now because he's not surprised at that because you have the temporary tower up and nobody's complaining.
The coverage is good. However, it's not the reliable coverage that we're designing for. Additionally,
I think you have too, though.
I have a Ford. He has a.
I think you said Rick last. It's covering, but it's not covering in full because you had pictures of it. What it would be at 100, it would be colored in a little bit more.
Exactly.
They're not complaining about that though, right?
To the edges of the current temporary pole would where you would start to become unreliable, as well as in the heart of town where the signal cannot get over the clutter and down into the low-lying areas.
Now, how high is those poles? Those poles are only 20, 25 feet?
20 feet. The utility poles? Yes, right. 20 feet.
And you couldn't mount anything on it? I'm just asking this again so I can clear this in my mind.
You could mount an antenna on
anything on there that would substantiate that area.
You would roughly need at least 20 of those locations. It's also important to note that they are much closer to the residential areas. They typically are on the people's driveway or, you know, right where they store their garbage.
You're saying it interferes with the signal.
Exactly. You have a house or trees that are in the near field, as we call it, very close to where the antennas are, blocking the signal before it even gets a chance to propagate. That's why the footprint for those are dramatically smaller, 500 to 1,000 feet, whereas with the proposed facility, we can achieve a mile up to a mile and a half, depending on the direction and the clutter, of reliable service.
You were saying there was complaints, right, prior to putting up the temporary tower?
Yes.
Was there a lot? I mean, give me a figure. Give me something.
All I can tell you is that there were complaints. AT&T ran its software, and we have the maps in the book in front of you that show reliable and unreliable coverage. And as Mr. Riffle testified last month, especially during the summer, we had that chart showing you how dramatic.
Right.
During the summer, you would see probably an 80% fail rate for calls now without this temporary tower in place. And only a 20% success rate.
Picked up that 80%?
It's about 93%, 94% with the temporary tower there.
So, if I may,
sure.
Let's approach this same question from a different angle. You constructed a temporary 80-foot tower. Why did you not construct a 100-foot temporary tower?
I believe the constraint is just the structural capability of a wood pole.
Of a wood pole. Okay.
I have no other questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
You're talking about the generator. Is that a self-contained generator?
I'm probably not the best person to answer that question, but I believe it is contained within the shelter. If you have further questions.
Self-contained, I mean it's the tank's already on the generator.
So now we're definitely in territory that I'm not an expert on. You probably want to ask.
You're talking about the gas that runs the generator?
Yes, it's diesel.
Yeah.
You know what the runtime would be on that?
I can't tell you that, but Mr. Calabretta may be able to tell you that.
Sorry, what was the question again?
It's a self-contained generator.
Yes.
What's the runtime on that?
When you say runtime, you mean for testing?
No, fuel.
Fuel-wise.
Fuel-wise.
Say you lost electric during the storm down there, and you need that generator running, what would be the runtime on that?
It depends on the tank capacity. Tank size is roughly 225 gallons.
On that tank?
Correct. It's about 3 feet tall, 3 feet wide, and about 8 feet long. It sounds like a lot. 200 gallons sounds like a huge amount.
That's what I got mine, 250 gallons.
I'm sorry?
That's what I got mine, 250 gallon tank.
Yeah.
That's a good size tank.
Yes, it sounds like an old tank. Yeah, it's good size.
Correct.
But it's self-contained. It's
in a room inside the shelter. The shelter itself.
A separate tank, then. It's not self-contained. It's not itself. It's a self-tank inside a room.
Correct. The shelter itself is 12 feet by 28 feet long.
Okay.
8 feet of that is its own room. It's a separate partition from the equipment room next to it. There are two doors, one accessing the generator, one accessing the equipment itself. That 8-foot room with the generator in it holds the generator as well as the tank.
As a tank, okay.
It's sitting on the tank. It's a steel base, essentially, for the generator and sitting on the tank. That's normally the option. Another option could be natural gas, perhaps, depending on other issues. But that's normally the case.
Okay. I didn't know what size tank you had on that. So that'll run quite a while, like 4 or 5 gallons an hour with your burn.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, I have you up there. You were commenting about the base, how far down you have to go for this tower,
sure.
And et cetera, based on the soil, okay,
or correct.
Where it's located. When Sandy came through, which was a good one of my colleagues asked you about that, it had no effect on the temporary tower. Is that correct? That's what you told me.
I believe that the structure was already up. I don't believe that there were any negative effects.
I believe they stated that it was.
Yes.
Right,
it was already up,
yes.
And it had no effect on it. Is that correct?
None that I'm aware of.
Okay. In your opinion, if you go up another 20 feet and then you make this whatever you have to do to accommodate a 100-foot tower, do you feel that that would be sufficient? Would they make that sufficient? Do you feel that would have had any impact on that at all?
It will be designed for the soil conditions and also the environmental specifics of this area. The wind speed in this area ranges from 90 to 120 miles per hour on a minimum and a maximum size. The site will be designed for the code required maximums. So I believe it would end up being about 120 miles in that facility. So that's the wind speed that structure would be designed for.
And it had, as far as you guys know, it had no effect on that tower.
Correct.
I'm not aware of any negative effects.
That was a pretty good storm. That's the reason I'm asking.
Sure. Well, again, the codes themselves are written for severe storms. They're not written for your typical, once every 10 or 20-year storm. The whole idea is that this structure would be able to withstand any foreseeable natural event. And it also deals with things like ice buildup, et cetera. It's not just wind, but ice and other loading that's required.
Yeah. NASA thought there was no problem with Challenger either. That's the reason I'm asking. You do have certain areas that you have to be in, right? Is that you're saying that the safety?
Correct. There are factors of safety that, frankly, allow the wind speed to actually go up. But the design wind speed, what we call your basic wind speed, is 120 miles per hour.
Okay.
There are factors of safety that actually increase that. So theoretically, it's going to be above that, frankly. And,
okay.
And again, as engineers, all we have are the codes.
Right.
I mean, if the codes were to say a 200-mile-an-hour wind, guess what we would be designing this for? 200 miles an hour. We would just do the work required to make that structure meet that code.
Right. All right, thank you.
Okay, I, again, unless anybody has further questions, I'll call the next person. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Tom Balma?
Good evening. Can you state your name and address for the record?
Tom Zolna, Z-O-L-N-A, 200 North Warner, W-A-R-N-E-R, Road, King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, 19406.
You swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Zolna, could you just briefly remind the board what your profession is and why you're here tonight on behalf of AT&T?
I'm responsible for the real estate work on the project, finding the site, things like that.
And I really just have two quick questions for you. Excuse me. During the last hearing, we were asked by one of the board members if other carriers were looking for a tower in the Bethany Beach area, and we speculated that Verizon would probably be looking for space on this tower if it was approved. Since that hearing, has there been a further development?
Yes, I contacted a person I know at Verizon to see if there was any interest, and I found out that Verizon has identified a need for a site in the area.
And if this tower is approved, would Verizon be able to use it, thereby eliminating the need for them to construct a tower of their own?
Yes, they could.
I just wanted, it had been asked, and I just wanted to add that information to make the record complete. So I have no further questions unless someone here does.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Bill McCain.
Good evening. Can you state your name and address for the record?
William McCain, my address is 5298 James Landing Road, Salisbury, Maryland.
Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Mr. McCain, could you briefly remind us of your profession, qualifications, and role here tonight on behalf of AT&T?
Yes, I'm president and CEO of W.R. McCain & Associates. We're a real estate valuation company. We have offices in Ocean View and Salisbury, and I have a certified general appraiser license in Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. And my educational background is I have an economics degree from Washington College and a master's in business administration degree from Salisbury University, and I've been practicing as a real estate appraiser for 28 years, and I'm also the incoming president of the Delaware chapter of the Appraisal Institute.
Okay, thank you. Mr. McCain, you looked at the effect of the temporary tower that's there now on rentals, didn't you?
That is correct.
And in fact, you submitted a report, which was in the notebook that we gave you all, that concluded the temporary tower had no effect on the unit owner's ability to rent. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I mentioned during my opening, and I believe you were here and heard the testimony of one of those unit owners whose unit looks out at the Arby's parking lot, and he testified that he's able to fully rent his unit every summer, although not to the same renters. Based on his testimony, do you believe that his ability to rent has been substantially adversely affected by the temporary tower?
No, the fact that he's able to fully rent his unit every summer, and then obviously it's not being adversely affected by the cell tower.
And as part of your review of the impact on rentals, did you look at online comments left by renters at Sea Pines?
Yes, I did.
And what did those comments show?
The comments, I actually found 59 comments online from renters that had rented in Sea Pines, and some of the comments are just addressing the general things about being satisfied or dissatisfied with their rental units. There were mentions, the dissatisfactions did address things such as views of the crab house, views of looking at the rear of the pep-up station and the security lights from the pep-up station, as well as some commented on the smell that resonated from the crab house in the summertime.
And were there any complaints about the cell tower?
Of the 59 reviews, zero mentioned the cell tower, not one.
We have a set of the comments online that we're happy to turn in and make part of the record, Jamie.
We hand it over to Mr. Lank.
Well, Mr. McCain, I believe you testified earlier that you're a member of the Appraisal Institute. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And is the Appraisal Institute the professional body that, I'll say, kind of governs the appraisal industry and sets forth the best standards and practices for the appraisal industry?
Yes, it is.
And as part of your membership in the Appraisal Institute, did you recently take part in a course on the effect of cell towers on property values?
Actually, just this past Thursday, the Appraisal Institute had a seminar, a webinar on the effect of property values from cell towers.
And if you could just briefly summarize the conclusions that the Appraisal Institute kind of instructed its members?
Yes, it had analyzed numerous subdivisions that had a cell tower located within or adjacent to the subdivision. In fact, I think it was 9 case studies that had been conducted. And in all those cases, it was found that the study revealed that there was no damage to property values to any residential, commercial, or any other properties. And there was no evidence found that quantified any damage to adjoining properties. And they concluded that there was no significant difference in sale prices of any of the properties.
And is that consistent with the data you found relating to Sea Pines?
Yes. This was very consistent with the local data as well that relate to Sea Pines.
Okay. I don't have any more questions for Mr. McCain, but it's certainly the board has.
Any questions, members of the board?
Not thank you.
These are all from comments from Sea Pines?
For people that rented in
yeah.
Sea Pines, that is correct.
Okay, thank
yes.
you.
Yes, in fact, it has the unit. Most of us have the unit number.
Unit number on it and everything?
Yes, right there to the, in the left, in the left-hand column.
Yes, okay.
The hardest thing you would agree in real estate, in the real estate business, not an exact science. But that means that your opinion, like your lawyer's opinion here, could say, well, geez, the gas station really, you know, that's the reason I don't want to pay any more money for that rental. And I may say the tower, and he may say the gas station. So you have, what you're telling me is that the complaints are 98% gas stations and whatever else there is other than the tower? Is that what you're saying?
That is correct. In all the online comments that were people made regarding the Sea Pines rentals, not one comment ever addressed the or ever mentioned cell tower.
I appreciate your background and everything, but where do these people come in that are complaining about it now? I mean, that they just don't get on the internet? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no renters are complaining about the cell tower.
There was a lot of them at the last meeting that were here.
Those were unit owners.
Those were the unit owners. There were no renters here at the last meeting.
Unit owners.
Right, it was unit owners.
Right, okay. That's what I wanted to hear, unit owners. Thank you.
And Mr. Rickard, not to put too fine a point on it, I've got one more witness to call, but, you know, we're looking at the data. We're looking at the actual sales data, and that's what forms the basis for Mr. McCain's opinion. That's what forms the basis for Mr. Trice's opinion. If the sales data showed that after the temporary tower was put up, that the Sea Pines condominium units went down while the rest of the market went up or stayed even, if it showed some divergence with the rest of the market, he's a professional. That would be his opinion then. We're basing it on the data. That's all we can do.
We're basing it on his opinion. Right.
Well, his opinion is based on the sales data, though.
And the other expert was here based on...
Well, with all due respect, we're about to talk about those other reports because they're not really appraisals. They're not really well done. So that's their next witness.
Yeah, thank you.
I'd like to call Mr. Leland Trice.
Good evening. You state your name and address for the record.
Leland Trice, 1003 Mount Hermon Road, Salisbury, Maryland.
You swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Trice, can you briefly remind us of your profession, your qualifications, and your role here tonight on behalf of AT&T?
Yes, I've been in the appraisal business since 1987. I have an economics degree from University of Maryland, certified general appraiser in Maryland, Delaware, and Virginia, and I'm currently the president of the Trice Group.
Okay. Back on November 18th, opponents introduced reports from two individuals, a Mr. Piper and a Mr. Handy, which purported to opine on the issue of property values. Have you had a chance to review those reports?
Yes, I did.
All right. Well, let's start with Mr. Piper's report. Mr. Piper's report was introduced, but he didn't actually testify at the hearing, did he?
No.
And have you having had a chance to review his report, what can you tell me about it?
Mr. Piper's report was prepared in 2011. It doesn't really do any analysis with respect to the Sea Pines community itself. It doesn't look at market trends. It really doesn't do an appraisal. Secondly, it consisted primarily of a questionnaire that was faxed to some 200 realtors in the area, of which he received 18 responses. That's a pretty limited number of responses, and frankly, this type of a survey is not really typically the basis for an appraiser to form a professional opinion.
Well, are surveys of realtors considered evidence of fair market value of properties?
Not really evidence. Factual sale prices are objective data. This is really just anecdotal data.
Right. And just for the record, Jamie, I cited in the previous briefing to Judge Graves that surveys are not accepted as evidence of value or as a basis for an opinion. What else can you tell us about Mr. Piper's report?
He referenced some house sales in the mid-2000s in the Southampton community where he claimed he found two houses closer to a tower. However, those he indicated only sold for 3 to 4% less than the other homes. He cited one house that sold for 12.3% less than average, but he also indicated it sold in half the time as average, which could suggest some quick sale influence there. He didn't document the comparables used. He didn't talk about any adjustments that were made. And frankly, a 3 to 4% difference in price is within a margin of error.
And did Mr. Piper cite any industry publications in his report?
He did. He referenced two other studies claiming that they indicated cell towers have a negative effect on value.
Did you review those reports?
I did. One, he said, had a, quote, major determinant on value. This was a 2005 report by a Tom J. Keith. And I reviewed that report, and it says, quote, the tower does not affect the value of properties as distance increases from the tower. It looked at concentric rings of prices around the tower, and the price per square foot of properties in those concentric rings was virtually identical. That report actually concludes the exact opposite of what Mr. Piper said. Mr. Piper also looked at a 2007 report by Samantha Bond. That report concluded the tower may affect a minimum value of 2% on value.
So is it fair to say then that the Piper report really doesn't provide any evidence of the effect of AT&T's tower on the surrounding properties?
That is correct. Reports that he cited don't really support the conclusion he made, and the survey that he referenced is not evidence of value. Mr. Piper made no effort to look at the C-Pines date itself. He didn't do a updated study, as Mr. McCain and myself did, where we had the luxury of looking at actual sales data that occurred before the current poll was there and after the poll was there.
Okay. Then what about Mr. Handy's reports? Mr. Handy did a report for 2011, and then he updated it for 2013. Have you reviewed those two reports?
Yes, I did review both of those.
So going in reverse chronological order, let's start with 2013. What did you find in that report?
In the 2013 report, he did something very interesting in that his opinion was based on the ratio of the sale prices to the list prices.
And just so we're clear, I mean, what's the difference between the list price and the sales price?
Well, the list price is the original asking price, and then the sale price is the meeting of the minds. That's what the buyer and seller actually agreed to.
And so is list price considered evidence of fair market value to a professional appraiser such as yourself?
It is not, because it can be anything one wants it to be.
Okay. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No. He looked at sales before and after 2010. There's an error that we found. The lowest value that he referenced on page 7 of his report, referring to a unit 29, he indicated sold for a very low price of $171,000 in 2010. The reality is, it looks like he transposed some numbers. That unit actually sold in 2000, not 2010. Let's see.
And we have a copy of that deed, just so the record's clear on that point. So what was the effect then of including this unit sale from 2010? What mistakes did that cause?
Well, again, in looking at his examination of the relationship of the list price to the sale price, which I don't believe is really even relevant, he used two sales that were distressed sales, one which sold at auction and one that was a short sale. He used a sale that was a private sale that didn't have a list price, so he effectively made up a list price, attributed a list price to that unit. And he concluded that there was an average discount of 17.3%, which in his opinion was high, of the list price to the sale price. However, if you back out the two distress sales, if you back out this sale that really occurred in the year 2000, the range then goes from 1.6% off the list price to a high of 16.7% off the sale price for an average of 10.87% off the list price, which to me is not remotely abnormal.
Finally, he didn't do any sort of analysis based on actual sales price to show effects. In his report, he said he's only applying a, quote, reasonable man standard. Is the, quote, reasonable man standard something that is used in the appraisal industry?
Not really. What I did and what I believe Mr. McCain attempted to do or did do was look at factual, objective, statistical data to support our opinion of value. Mr. Handy also, I noted on page 8 of his report, has a chart that purports that the sale prices are affected based on their proximity to the pole. However, in reading Mr. Handy's report, it appears as if he simply applied this judgment of his own just opinion on this chart, and I can't see where there's any actual factual data used to produce this chart.
And so, in sum, I believe you said this before, but let's just get it on the record one more time. Based on your review of the actual sales data at both Sea Pines and in the market as a whole, both before and after the tower went up, do you believe that the temporary tower has substantially adversely affected the surrounding properties?
No, I do not.
Okay, this is, I think, I have no further questions unless members of the board.
Any questions from members of the board?
All right.
Thank you.
Members of the board, that is the end of our submission or our witnesses. I just want to sum up briefly with where we started several weeks ago, and that's simply with this fact. I mean, AT&T wouldn't be here tonight if there wasn't a need for this tower. We wouldn't have spent 9 years, it's actually been, trying to get a location, putting this tower up. I could put up all the charts, but in the interest of time, they're in your notebook, I won't. But we demonstrated the number of calls that this temporary tower has handled, particularly during the summer, which is what the network's designed for, because that's when there's the demand. People are on vacation, but they want to use their iPads and their iPhones and everything else. We just wouldn't be here if this site wasn't needed. And this is the only site that we've been able to find. And it's funny, because you'll recall back in November when Bethany Beach was actually considering the water tower, there were two residents who spoke out against putting the antennas at the water tower. Ms. Shirley Dorfman said she was of the opinion the tower should be erected where it is being proposed, outside the corporate limits of Bethany Beach. And Mr. Tim Haley was against it. He explained that it would, quote, be in his backyard if the antenna were put on the water tower. I mean, nobody wants these things in their own backyard, but of course, they want the service. This is handling nearly a million emails per day, 2 911 calls per day, 25,000 calls during peak demand during the summer. Mr. Riffle testified back in November and reminded you tonight that with this tower, the success rate for calls is about 93% to 94%. Without this tower, that drops to about 20%. And at the hearing, there had been some confusion in years past about what constituted a significant gap in coverage for purposes of the Federal Telecommunications Act. And the court said, although there can be no hard and fast percentage of failed calls to define a significant gap, the court concludes that a line of demarcation falling somewhere between 1.96% and 5% to 7% is a reasonable interpretation of the Federal Telecommunications Act. So we get to that point with this tower, but without this tower, under the case law, we're not there. And I had previously cited that case. I just want to run through very briefly the actual standards for the grant of a special exception and the tower in this location. While we can never satisfy our critics, we've submitted documentation and testimony that the existing towers in the area are too far away. They won't solve this gap. Even if we could go on the South Bethany Water Tower, it doesn't solve, and we can't. It doesn't solve the problem. If we could go on the Bethany Beach, it would satisfy, but we can't go there. Second, we actually meet the standards set forth in the code about room for additional carriers. We have to provide room for two additional carriers, and we will, and this is something carriers do for each other all over the place, and so it didn't surprise me. We speculated a couple weeks ago that Verizon would be interested. We've actually learned they are now starting the process themselves for this area. So, we're not the only ones with needs here. The code requires that this a cell tower only be set back one-third of its height from a property line. We're actually set back more than the height of the tower from the Sea Pines community. And the property to the north, we're set back two-thirds of the height. That property, somebody pointed out at the previous hearing, is approved for seven condominium. It's actually approved, I looked it up, for seven condominium units. It got that approval in 2003. Nothing happened. It got that approval renewed in 2009. It remains undeveloped. They're not here tonight anyway. The site otherwise complies with all the applicable construction requirements, and there were questions asked of Mr. Calabretta about that. And it's interesting, Judge Graves in the previous case had an interesting comment about the video showing a cell phone a tower on fire and these other concerns. And he said, if you have to build, how about if you have to build to national code? Then the code sets the standards for cell towers. It seemed to me, this is Judge Graves, that there was an emotional element thrown in with the fire video. If you build to code, bad things can happen. But you build to code, what else can AT&T do but build to code? And I think it's really unfair, especially when we've actually exceeded what the Sussex Code requires, to nevertheless complain about things that rarely happen. I mean, condominium units catch on fire. We are in car accidents. Finally, Section 115-210 of the code requires that for a special exception, we have to show that the tower will not substantially affect adversely the uses of adjacent and neighboring property. That's the key. That's the key language. And as I said earlier tonight and a few weeks ago, AT&T understands that people don't like things in their backyards. They want their iPhones. They want their iPads. They want their smartphones. They want a Twitter. They want a text. They want to watch Netflix. They don't like cell towers, and I get that, and AT&T certainly gets it. But AT&T's customers have a need. And in looking at whether there is a substantial adverse effect, all we can actually do is look at the data. Because we've got data here. That data might have showed something else, but all I can do and all that Mr. Trice can do and all that Mr. McCain can do is look at the data and say, this is what the data tells us. And what does the data tell us? It tells us, and we had a chart, and that just as the market behaved, so did the properties at Sea Pines. That's what the data tells us. And so if the units, and in fact it also tells us that out of sales over the last 2 years, six of the top 10 have been at Sea Pines. So if there was a substantial adverse effect, I don't think we'd be seeing that. The data would be saying something else, and opponents would be all over that. But they haven't cited to you any actual data that demonstrates a substantial adverse effect when you look at Sea Pines versus the market as a whole. Now, I get that that seems counterintuitive. How is it that putting up a tower in the area doesn't have a substantial adverse effect? And the answer is because there's everything else that's there. There are the power transmission lines. There's an Arby's there's an Arby's with a drive-through that's lit. There's the gas station, which used to be a Pep Up, now it's a BP. There's a restaurant that serves crabs and apparently serves so many crabs that people staying at Sea Pines have complained about the smell. There's all those things. And these are people who, some of them own property. Some of the renters who are there for the first time, they don't even notice the cell tower. It's just part of the clutter. That's what the professional literature tells us. That's why the market data doesn't show an effect. So I don't know what else we can do except say this is what the data itself shows. And unless you have any other questions, I'll go and sit down. And I thank you for your patience, and I thank you for your time.
Okay, are there any questions? Hearing none? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we're going to stand.